Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Event Industry News Podcast with me, James Dixon, wishing you all a very good morning, evening, or afternoon, whenever, wherever you join us from or tune into from today. For context, as we do at the start of most of our podcast recordings, I'd like to give you the date that we are recording this because such is the nature of this type of media that people consume. You could be listening to this at any point in the future. It could be 2042 and you're listening to this podcast. So we're recording this on Monday, the 15th of January, 2024. Plenty of episodes being recorded like we try and do at the start of January, to see us through the spring season. And as I said on some of the earlier recordings that you may have already been listening to this year, some of our podcasts today or this spring season are not going to be on a particular topic. We are getting guests on to talk about their experience in the industry, talk about their own sort of pathways, talk about the events that they run, that the events that they work on, and really just see where some of these conversations evolve to. People are the lifeblood of this industry, and so people is what we're focusing on this spring. And I'm delighted to say that that person joining us today is Laura Shapiro. Laura, welcome to the Event Industry News Podcast.
Hi there, morning.
Good morning, and thank you for joining. I always like to say thank you to people who join us first thing on a Monday morning as well. You know, it's never the easiest thing to do after a nice sort of relaxing weekend, hopefully, to wake up.
And it was minus four this morning, so absolutely, yeah, it was super hard.
To wake up on a Monday morning and go, oh, crap, I've got to do a podcast recording this morning. You know, and kudos to Tom Fisher as well from Clarion Events. He was on at 9 a.m. this morning. You know, he was straight out of the blocks.
Yeah.
Laura, how are you? Where are you joining us from this morning?
So good morning. Well, good afternoon. Depends when you're listening to this. I am actually in our Midlands office this morning, which is where I'm based in central Coventry. We have about, I think we did a count last week, actually. We've got 55 staff now in our Coventry office, and it's actually where Closer Still started all those years ago. 15 years ago, we started in a small office. We've moved since then as we've grown. But yeah, I'm based up here in the Coventry office.
Brilliant. Yeah, Coventry. I've worked there a few times, worked at the arena there under the stadium many times. Great venue there, actually. You know, slightly off on a tangent at the start of this episode, but it's a great events venue underneath the stadium there.
It is. Yeah, I've only been twice, actually, I think, in my whole life. So it is a good venue right on the M6, so easy to get to, but is under the shadow of the NEC, I guess, not too far away.
Yeah, did you say shadow? But you know, it's the NEC. It's I don't know if I love it or hate it. The NEC. The car park's a mess. It seems to take ages to get anywhere. Or to navigate around it, but I guess that's the nature of a venue that's expanded so much over the years.
Yeah, the moment is the roadworks on the outside, but once they are finished, whenever that might be, it will definitely be much easier to get to. I mean, obviously, I would drive there. A lot of people from London will get the train. That's pretty easy, though. We're lucky to have a great venue in the two great venues in the Midlands.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And you know, a lot of our conversations on here with event organisers and event companies are often London centric as well. So it's nice to speak to somebody who works for a company and a big, you know, event organiser who's not London sort of based and who's based in the Midlands and can maybe.
It's maybe important to be geographically diverse as well as all, you know, the other, you know, protected characteristics that we, you know, we're working with at the moment. It's really important to have a idea about what people outside of London think and where they're willing to travel to, and are they willing to travel to London anymore? And to be honest, we have seen a trend that people outside of London and the home counties and Kent and that kind of thing are less inclined to travel to London for a show. And so, you know, what have we done about that in the last 12 months? And I'm sure we can come on to some of as we go through.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a step back a little bit then before we go down that route and just find out a little bit more about yourself and about Closer Still, so that we've got a bit of context for people listening to this today. First of all, tell us about yourself, Laura, and your sort of career pathway so far in the events industry and what Closer Still does, the portfolio of events that you guys look after.
Okay, so I'm sure lots of people know who I am. I've done a couple of these over the last few years, but I am a portfolio director now at Closer Still. I have been for the last year. It was actually a new role that Closer Still brought in last year to sort of formalise each of the different divisions, I guess, within the different portfolios that we have. So I specifically work in the healthcare cluster, but I'm the medical portfolio director. So I'm responsible for 12 of our medical events, and medical being hospital doctors, pharmacists, GPs. And then we also run a number of what we would class as horizontal therapeutic events, so diabetes, oncology, respiratory, and also cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So we look at individual types of healthcare professionals, but also individual therapy areas as well, which will be multidisciplinary. Same as any industry, you have different departments coming together. So the same sort of thing there. But Closer Still also have a healthcare portfolio. So care, show, dentistry. We have a community pharmacy event as well. Big animal healthcare division as well, which are the vet shows. And then for outside of the healthcare cluster, we have the technology cluster, and we also have the learning technologies cluster as well. Both of those are global clusters, whereas the healthcare cluster, we have two events in Spain and France, but we haven't gone any wider than that yet. So yeah, I'm pretty much UK. Well, I am UK-based, UK shows based. I started at Closer Still 12 and a half years ago, so I've been here quite a long time. Part of the furniture, as I often say.
Yeah, I was going to say that in the modern sort of workplace, that's
a long time.
You're a lifer.
Definitely. Though having been one of the kind of original 20 or so employees, really, you know, help the team craft the kind of foundations for the business. Obviously, as we've grown, you know, we must be nearly at 700 staff now. So, you know, that we're not a small company. I would argue we're not even a small medium company. We're heading towards medium large. We're not in large yet, but you know, we're definitely medium large. And that that's how I see it anyway. You know, certainly that's my opinion of it. And the differences between, you know, even 5 years ago and now are very different. You know, we have a lot of support departments. We have a digital team. I think you're due to also speak to Rakeem at some point in the next few. So, you know, you'll really get an idea about the scope of what the digital team have done and what they're able to support both marketing, sales across the global business. You know, having those different support departments has made an enormous difference.
It's interesting you say that about the digital team and these support departments, because this is something that's cropped up very, very recently on the podcast, is almost this, well, it's not new roles, but how we've evolved over the last 10 or 15 years because of the amount of data that we're now fed, because of the systems and the processes that we have in place to plan, run and execute our events. We've now got these digital teams that, you know, 15 years ago wouldn't have existed because we need.
Well, five years ago, I would argue they probably didn't exist, certainly in the capacity that they do now. Mm. You know, I have to be honest, it's certainly not my area of expertise. And, you know, but that's why having some experts, you know, we're experts at selling, putting an event on, but actually now we have experts at digital marketing. And it isn't just helping get delegates to a show, which is what most people think it is. There's, you know, opportunities there within the sales team as well. You know, a lot of what we're doing, you know, obviously using pay-per-clicks and having the retargeting. I mean, that's literally as much as, you know, that's probably the extent of my vocabulary in this department. But, you know, it's, you know, those kind of things. And also having the next generation of team members joining us as well. They have a totally different kind of outset and what they're looking for from an event, and actually being, again, using that diversity thing as well as having age is important, and having a wide range of age, not just youngest but also older people as well.
Sure,
because what do they want out an event? What do they want from coming to, you know, coming into a workplace as well, not, you know, not just looking at our solely at our trade shows. So yeah, I think it's really important to have different diversity as well, and you know, different staff off that, and the digital team have got something that most people don't have, and that's really great.
And I guess that diversity will filter then into your audiences and your attendees. Given sort of medical and healthcare, there are so many then different strands to that and areas of expertise for people who work in that industry. If you think, you know, doctors, just the sheer amount of different sort of specifics that a doctor or a consultant or a healthcare professional could work in, I guess.
I think about the digital teams,
they must be able to analyze the demographics of who's there, and that opens up doors for you.
Absolutely. I think the prime example here is, you know, in pharmacy. So the show I came to closer still to run was Clinical Pharmacy Congress. I, with an expert exhibition director at the time, the two of us created the Clinical Pharmacy Congress. Let's just call it CPC because that's much easier. And the first thing, after a few years, we kind of started to look at obviously the demographics of the audience, and the over 50% of pharmacists in the UK are Muslim. So we ended up, Ramadan moves each year because it's on their calendar, not our 12th January to December calendar. And at one point, the show was going to fall in the middle of Ramadan. I was like, we can't do this because that's not right, I think the way I described it. And maybe I don't use the, you know, exactly the right words here. But the point is we consulted a load of pharmacists and asked them, would you prefer us if we actually moved the show outside of Ramadan, so back into June, because it's usually in May? And the overriding response was, yes, that would be amazing. And the amount of positive PR that we received for doing that was amazing, because the professional leadership body actually kept like a senior fellows dinner in the middle of Ramadan. And of course, a lot of those senior fellows are Muslim and therefore couldn't go to the dinner. So it's really important that you know your market. I mean, you hear that from lots of people in this industry. You have to know your audience. And if you know your audience and talk to your audience, and now we can talk to them through lots of different mediums, not just the phone or email, you will create a more harmonious community, which is what your event wants to be at the heart of. So it is, all these things come together, I think, to give us that, you know, we all want to be number one in class, don't we? That's all. Yeah. That's all of our goals is to be number one.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to this, when you referenced 5 years, you know, five for these digital teams, have you seen more transformation then in the recent years because of the information that you've got available than the previous sort of 7 or 8 that you worked at closer still?
I think so. And I think, I'll be honest, they've very much focused the last year and 18 months on the technology portfolio, because it's easier for kind of digital technology to fit with technology shows. And now the learnings that they've taken from those shows, they are now starting to roll out in the healthcare portfolio. And so it will be interesting, I think, in 12 months time to actually see what learnings have carried over, and how we can benefit from what the technology team have kind of forged a pathway, let's put it that way. And again, because it's easier to geoclone a technology show, you know, technologies, the computer's the same anywhere in the world, isn't it? But healthcare differs postcode by postcode in the UK, let alone another country. That's, again, these are all my opinions. That's what I understand is going to, you know, we're rolling out, but certainly a lot more work in the data side of things. We've done a massive project on data segmentation, you know, making sure that we are spending our budgets in the right places to get the right people to our events. Has been a real cathartic project, actually, over the last 6 months. It's another 6 months to go, really, to make sure, you know, sometimes going, yes, we've got the right, we are doing the right thing, or actually we've missed a whole, maybe one job title that our audience or our exhibitors, our clients really want to see. That's great though, because it means we've got something to target for the next year.
Going back to that conversation a little bit that we touched on right at the start then about locations, do you use that data then to shape where the shows take place, or do you generally try to keep them in the same place because it it helps the team from a planning and an execution point of view.
Yeah, so all of our show, we don't run any peripatetic events in the UK, so everything stays in the same venue or the same city. We have moved some between Olympia and XL, mm-hmm. But that's more to do with tenancy availability, and I would argue. But I actually, so Closer Still run events in London and Birmingham. That's it. Last year we ran our first event in Manchester, and that was through a lot of negotiation internally. most exhibition companies are London centric. You know, that's where the majority of people are in the UK. You know, there's the biggest amount of the population. We saw a decline, as I said, even pre-COVID, so 2019, in the number of, although the unique number stayed similar, or, you know, rose slightly, which on a legacy event is, you know, what you're looking for. We did see a decline in the percentage of audience coming from, I'm going to say, north of Birmingham. Let's, you know, divide the England in half. And so I started to look at this, and after COVID, again, the trend increased. Now, I'm sure everyone's seen similar things, because people, it's harder to travel. It's very expensive to travel, let's say, from Manchester to London, Newcastle to London. It's very expensive, and it's not, you can't do it in a day. It's impossible, and do a full day of learning at a trade event, or, you know, a conference or whatever. So I put together a proposal to actually geoclone one of my CPC, so my main show in my portfolio, the one I worked on myself for years, and wanted to launch an event, the same event in Manchester, but a smaller scale, so a sister event, essentially. And we ran that at the beginning of November last year, and it was incredible, because all my team are based in the Midlands as well, and so we all were like, this is brilliant, because actually it's not in London. We all travel to London all the time. We travel to the office, we travel to our events, we travel to other events. But to be able to go, you know, we weren't targeting people from London. If some came, obviously we're not, you know, if top pharmacists, technicians came from London, we're not going to say no, but we invested our budget in people from north of Birmingham, essentially. It helped us actually with the launch, because we had two train strikes in May on the 2 days of the London show.
Exactly.
Yeah. So thanks to train drivers for that. It was actually, for us, it was a blessing in disguise. And from exhibitors' point of view, those who did support us in that launch, some of their comments were incredible. Just, you know, I've met three chief pharmacists, so they're the most senior pharmacist, mm-hmm. that I've never, ever met before. They've never been to CPC, because they've done it for 10 years. And they did the Manchester one, and they got to see three people over 2 days. Some might say that's a terrible return, but if they're three chief pharmacists who have buying power, who they've never seen before, I would argue that's a fantastic return on whatever you spent.
It is when you look at the money that they could potentially then be spending with that supplier, and what it's cost the supplier to actually be there to do that.
Yep. In 10 years they'd exhibited at the London event, so they still support the London event, but that person hadn't gone to the London event. So by having a Northern event, it opened the doors to people who haven't been able to come. They all wanted to come. They never unsubscribed from the emails, so they saw all the delegate promotion, but just weren't able to come because it was too far, too expensive, and they couldn't get the time off.
Sure.
It was worth it.
is this where we have progressed as an industry, certainly in the exhibition industry, from headline statistics and headline data, as in how many people walk through the door, and we're in so much more of a sophisticated position now, where it used to just be about the sheer volume of numbers coming through the door, and you would have very little else really from a data point of view when we worked in a more analog operational sense, that now somebody can come to the show, speak to three people over 2 days, but class that as a really successful show, whereas when I think back to the first trade shows I went to, which is probably 2005, and seeing those, it was all about the headline statistics. How many people came through the door?
I think I do think so. I mean, there obviously are exhibitors who want volume, but your higher spending exhibitors, your bigger net worth, whatever, you know, whatever ways you want to describe them, you know, they want a specific type of person. And you know, you have maybe have different theatres or different streams of content that are aiming to actually drive that group of people to your event. It's very important. And again, I'll go back to that. What do your audience want? And that's not just what your delegates want. What do your exhibitors want? Mm. You know, we're all pitching. Salespeople are pitching. But when you ask, you know, okay, oh, it's not quite right for us. Well, what is right for you? Tell me what you want. Are we nearly there? Because if we're nearly there, I'm sure there's something that we could tweak to get who you get it so it is 100% for you or 75% right for you. But yeah, I do think so. I do think there are more opportunities for that kind of individual bespoke opportunities. And that's something actually our digital team have been experimenting with some of our tech shows. So again, it will be interesting to see that kind of... maybe that's something Rakim will talk to you about later, because he obviously he's the head of that team.
Yeah, we'll dive into that a little bit deeper when we get him on the show. I think it's scheduled next week. I keep for a day. Yeah. You never know when people are going to listen to these, but yeah, next week I think that one's scheduled in for. But you touched on something then. You mentioned the conference element of the show and the content that's actually been there, the educational content that attendees and delegates can go and see. How does that shape itself year on year in terms of how you put the programme of content together in the educational strands of the events? Is that really shaped by the people who deliver those sessions to you, telling you as organisers, look, this is what's happening in our sector at the moment. This is what we think needs to be on your conference programme. How much of a finger do you need to keep on the pulse of the industry to understand what's happening?
Well, you've really got to be in the industry. You've got to be seen as part of it rather than another party. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be at the heart of your event. So now we have a content team, a healthcare content team, and that really has come from during COVID, we hired a head of healthcare content, and now that team is 5 or 6 people. I mean, if just to put it in context, when I came to Closer Still, my job was also conference producer for the whole for CPC, as well as the sales manager, as well as the event manager, I guess. So I did pretty much did everything. But we were a startup company. Essentially, we were a startup company. And so, you know, it was, you know, we used to pack the delegate bags in the office. You know, that's how, you know, basic it was. I mean, we physically don't have the time for that. Though sometimes if a bag insert comes late from an important client, you'll see all the team on build day putting the last insert in the bag because it's important that your clients are happy. So content is delivered by a content team. They have advisory boards that are all members, delegates of your audience. Some of our shows will have a commercial member of the advisory board. It's difficult in medical side of healthcare. There's a lot of very strict rules and regulations, which I really won't go into because it'll bore everyone to death. But there are a lot of rules and regulations around what you can and can't do. Yeah. And so it's difficult to have a client on your advisory board, but that doesn't mean to say you can't speak to them on a one-to-one basis and get, especially when you've got your target audience working in a commercial company. So if you have a pharmacist who actually now works for, let's say, a pharmaceutical company, they're your perfect ally because they are your audience, but they're also your client. And so they wear two hats for us. So they're really useful people to have good networking with. And that's the same, I guess, in, you know, pretty much every industry. There will be people who've gone to the dark side and gone and worked for the commercial side of their role rather than kind of the, you know, if you're an engineer, then you go and be the sales manager or sales director for the company that you were building something for. You know, you've gone over and you're selling the product rather than building it. So I would argue that's probably quite similar.
this may seem up a bit of an odd question, but I just want to pick up on delegate bags, because when I've had conversations with people before, it's all very, very much dependent on the audience that you're serving as an event and the attendees that are coming to it. Some organizer moved to sort of digital content that, you know, delegates can go around and tap, you know, smart badges and things like that on exhibitors, on exhibitors stands and things like that. But delegate bags still work in certain audiences. So have you found that's because of your audience? You've got sponsors and exhibitors who really feel like they need to put something into the hands of the people coming to the show.
Our biggest spenders across the medical portfolio are pharmaceutical companies. And so they are quite, although they may come across as being quite new age, they're actually quite old fashioned this is my opinion. And so having a leaflet fits in a box that they can get approved and get a budget for. Yeah. Getting a digital QR code on their stand that people then scan and then they follow up doesn't fit in a box that they've already got approved. And so the industry is actually behind what's happening. Although they all want to be, you know, they're all trying to be sustainable and more green and everything, which we're all trying to do what we can. I do find that, you know, this is something that still works. That being said, we would only have delegate bags if a client provided them. We wouldn't make them ourselves for the show. Yeah. So they would have to be a sponsor item. So some of the shows don't have delegate bags, and it's more for that reason than any other. Some of our shows have moved away from a print show guide as well. But we still have to have a printed program. Yeah. So we would do like an A3 sheet with the program on one side and the floor plan on the other. Mm-hmm. Now, that is better because it's not 48 pages of printing times 3,000 or whatever. It's one sheet of paper. So it is a lot less. But we also need to be mindful of people who don't want to use their phone or can't use their phone, can't look at the app, you know, have bad eyesight. And so we always would have some copies of the program, because our events are very, very content heavy. You know, you're talking 250 sessions plus over 2 days. So if you don't have a grid of the program that people literally bring with them, with the sessions circled on them that they want to go to, you are going to miss people going to the right sessions.
How are you managing that volume of content? And I mean, you know, physically the speakers themselves, the people who are coming to either deliver a solo session or be part of a panel session, which I presume makes up some of the content as well. How you 250 sessions must mean that you've got at least 250 speakers, if not more, when you factor in panels.
Absolutely. So we have a great content team, as I've already mentioned, but we also have a speaker liaison team. So another, which is part of the operations department. So obviously the normal operations build the show, but the speaker liaison team liaise with the speakers once they're confirmed by the content team, and they will get their biographies, their synopses, all that kind of thing. And we are now, our systems are all integrated. They didn't used to be, as with everyone. So they go in a back office system, and then they appear on the website and on the app. To be honest, having no show guide is a blessing in disguise, because it's a lot of work. You know, constantly proofreading, at least with the web and the app, if there is a little error, quick typing, send it off, push it off to the website, and the error's disappeared. You know, it is, you know, there are some very positives to that.
I had that, you know, at Event Tech Live. I'm on the production team for Event Tech Live, and I remember, you know, day two of the show at XL last year, we had a last minute addition to a panel, and you know, within, you know, it took me 90 seconds to log on, add all their details into the back end, push publish, and it's API'd and it's pushing into the app, to the website, etc., etc. Once you commit to a printed show guide,
that's it. You know, it's always out of date.
It's effectively out of date, isn't it?
Yeah, the minute you've printed it, it's out of date. And that's why doing just a program grid, which is like a quick view, so it doesn't have all the synopses on it. It just has the session name and maybe the speaker's name, but not all their job titles. You know, you can then, I mean, if you had to, you could print it in the office. You know, on the events, the size that we're running, all of my events, you could run off 3,000 copies on the printer in the office if you had to the day before the event, you know, worst case scenario. But yeah, there's a lot of, and there's a, you know, those jumps and hurdles I mentioned, you know, that that causes quite a lot of stress and strife, you know, a month before the show, which is not really what you need at that point. So
Who's responsible?
We're moving away from them.
With your speaker liaison team, who's responsible for generating the synopsis of a particular session? Is that the person who is going to be delivering that session? Is there any tweaking of that done? I'm curious to ask, just from an SEO point of view, to make sure maybe that it could be refined with keywords that, that maybe...
I don't know, and I'm going to go and ask that question now. We don't tend to change people's synopses because that's what they've written and that's what they're going to talk about.
Sure.
But that is a very good question that I definitely should go and ask someone.
We changed
a spelling mistake.
Well.
Yeah, maybe you should ask him. That's a really good one and I'll definitely listen to the answer. But we would definitely, if it's a typo or something, you know, we'd change that. But we wouldn't, as far as I'm aware, and I certainly didn't when I was producing the conference program, I wouldn't change something unless there was like something that was sort of critical. You know,
sure.
Don't call your audience this, call them that. I mean, one example is in the UK, pharmacists don't wear white coats. They don't represent themselves like doctors. So don't use an image on all your promotional materials of a person in a white coat. Whereas in the States,
okay,
they do wear white coats.
Yes.
And so you've got to make sure, again, I'm coming back to that whole, you've got to know your audience, know who you're talking to, you know, make sure that you, and that information is cascaded to any new members of the team. You know, these are kind of the 10 or top 5 things to remember or know about your sector that, you know, you must imprint on your brain.
No, absolutely.
Don't make these mistakes, basically.
A whole other conversation, isn't it, when you're dealing with an internationally, you know, just you know, having to understand, you know, subtle differences that can have a big impact.
Yes.
You know, I found when dealing with an American audience, you've got to Americanize all your spellings.
Yeah.
You know, just to
know you in color.
Yeah, and Z's instead of S's in words, in organization or something like that, you know,
yeah.
You've got to, you have got to tweak, because I find that even the smallest mistake that might seem really insignificant can actually not offend people, but it can actually make people think, oh well, they don't understand their audience. I'm not doing that.
I'm not going there. Yeah. Totally agree with you.
Terminology is so important. And crikey, I dread to think sort of the amount of terminology that you guys have to be aware of working in medical, healthcare,
pharmaceutical. Oh, the acronyms are ridiculous. You know, there's the NHS have produced a jargon buster, which is basically a 20-page document with all the different acronyms on it, which so just puts it in context. So, yes, we have a lot of acronyms, but doesn't everyone?
Well, absolutely. But again, there's a serious point in there, isn't there? That if you are serving an audience and you're wanting to ultimately make money, you know, from a particular sector, you know, but you're in business to make money and you're only going to do that by knowing the sector, knowing your onions.
So we realised a couple of years into doing CPC that CPC is also, if you do hashtag CPC, it's also Conservative Party Conference.
Oh, brilliant.
So theirs luckily was in the second half of the year and we were the first half. But when we got better Twitter traction, and so people were tweeting all year round and we have more content year round, we realised come party conference season that actually we had the same to handle. So we changed our hashtag. The handle was okay, but the hashtag we changed to CP Congress because it's Clinical Pharmacy Congress.
Sure.
And you know, that stuck. But when new people start, they automatically go for hashtag CPC. You're like, no, we can't have that because although they're different sectors. I mean, there is quite a lot of medical representation in the party conferences and you don't want to compete with one of the political parties. Let's just be honest. It's just easier to change ours.
Well, you know, that's a whole other podcast in itself, touching on on mistaken hashtags, which, you know, it just Google, you know, the mistaken use of hashtags in PR and you'll come across some of the legendary stories about.
Oh, I might have to do that.
Oh,
if I need a pick me up, maybe a little bit of a laugh.
I won't go with the Susan Boyle one. Google the Susan Boyle hashtag, everybody. I'll not say it on air because it's rude. But the other one akin to that was when Margaret Thatcher died, and the hashtag trending on Twitter was "Now Thatcher is dead." Now, unfortunately, the Americans, nobody knew who Thatcher was particularly, so they read the same words as "Now that Cher is dead." And so people in the UK hashtagging "Now Thatcher is dead," people in the US, generally there was a period of time, I think 48, 72 hours, where a lot of people in America thought that Cher had passed away because of that hashtag.
Wow.
And you know, it just goes to highlight how careful sometimes.
You've got to be super careful.
We've got to be super careful when you're putting stuff out there because, you know, when there's no spaces involved in hashtags, you know, you've got to think, does it clash with anything? And there's still so many people that I see that don't bother to check stuff before it goes out and see, just do a quick search. Does it clash with something else? And you know, there's a lesson to us all there.
There is definitely a lesson to be learned. Yeah, absolutely. Check and check again.
check again. Do it right. Do it once.
What is it? They say measure twice, cut once.
Oh, the old tradesman.
The wallpaper.
Handle, definitely. Yeah, measure twice, cut once. We're getting towards the end of time on today's episode, Laura. But before we start thinking about wrapping up today, it's always something that we ask to give people who've come on the podcast the opportunity to maybe allow our audience to get in touch with them, find out a little bit more about them. So before we wrap up today, just tell us how people can find out a little bit more about Closer Still and the portfolio shows that you guys run.
So the comms team just launched a brand new website at the back end of last year. So you can hop on the website, closerstillmedia.com. Loads and loads of information about us in there now. I remember when I started, our website was one page and it had the three founders' email addresses on it, and that was it. So try going for a job interview then and trying to work out what Closer Still Media did was quite difficult. There's a careers page on there as well. I think we've got some various roles across the globe available in various different departments. So, you know, you can always sign up as well and select your different preferences. And if jobs come up, then it will email you when those jobs go live. We're always on the lookout for good people. Mm. You can get me on LinkedIn. And I'm always at various different events as well, although I won't be at Confex this year because it clashes with one of my shows, unfortunately. I'm often at, obviously I'm the president of Women in Exhibitions, so you can meet me a lot of the Women in Exhibitions events if your company's a member, or you can reach out on LinkedIn. Use LinkedIn quite a lot, you can find me as Laura Shapiro on there.
And I've been on the website this morning. It is a good website.
Well, there you go. The comms team will be very happy with that.
Modern, easy to navigate, nice, clear menu bar, about us. You know, I'm loath to point out that there are still a huge amount of event websites that don't have the actual basic information that you're looking for on there in a really easy to find way. It's amazing how deep you've got to go into some companies' websites to find out what they actually do and get a clear explanation on what about us means.
I often find that with our clients. Our clients often, and then you can't find a phone number either, and you're like, how do potential customers ring you? That's again, that possibly might be a whole nother podcast.
That's a late night. That's a late night whinge podcast, that one, definitely. Our guest today on the Event Industry News podcast has been Laura Shapiro from Closer Still Media. Do go and check those guys out. Loads of stuff happening with them and a careers page, as I said. So if anybody's listening to this who's looking for new opportunities, go and check out the new website there and have a look at any opportunities that might be available via those guys. Of course, before we wrap up today's episode, a little shout out for our own bits and pieces that we've got going off. We've got eventindustrynews.com. So if you're listening to the podcast today via your audio podcast provider, please don't forget to head over to eventindustrynews.com, where you will find the latest news, features, special supplements that are published by the sales team and the team over at Event Industry News. And of course, the A to Z supplier directory. If you work in the events industry, you're looking for a product, a service, or a supplier, the chances are you'll find it on the A to Z supplier directory on eventindustrynews.com, where you can also find video versions of all of our podcasts as well. Of course, you may have started your journey there today by watching the video of this podcast on Event eventindustrynews.com. If you have, thank you very much for tuning in. And don't forget to go in the opposite direction and make sure that you subscribe to the audio versions of the podcast wherever you get them from, whether it's Spotify. You can subscribe to the YouTube channel and watch them on there as well. And of course, via your podcast platforms. Thanks very much again, Laura, for joining us today. It's been great to chat
to
you.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
And we will see you all and hear you all on the next edition of the Event Industry News podcast. Thanks very much, everybody. Cheers.